We operate in a somewhat controversial space. We do artificial intelligence. We're probably best known for face recognition. And so we want to make sure that face recognition is ethically developed, that it's deployed with customers who are going to use it responsibly.
How is Paravision positioning themselves to be an organization that develops technology that truly allows for all members of every community to be fully seen, literally and figuratively?
Yeah, we frequently say, if it doesn't work for everyone, it doesn't work for anyone. And it's actually the intersection of age, gender, and skin tone. And I think that's actually really important. It's not a single-threaded thing.
Where's the precision piece?
And where's the precision piece? Right. And so if I am a person of a particular skin tone and I'm walking into an airport and I want to be treated a certain way, would I rather have a person who is a completely different skin tone than me and may have their own biases built into their own thinking, checking my ID and giving me a hard time? Or would I rather have a team that is across a pretty wide spectrum of races, religions, genders, et cetera, who's built software that was built for them? And it was built for the world with this inclusion included as part of the mix.
So you're actually proposing, what I'm hearing is, to a very inclusive way of being in this world around a technology that could actually create safety for communities of color that maybe in the past have not experienced that level of safety before.
Doug Ailey, and belonging to me is within a group of people and a set of norms, feeling safe, feeling seen, heard, and really known.
Doug.
Nash Kumari.
You have been building businesses for most of your life. You founded startups, you've run businesses, you have been part of established brands. Your career spans Amazon, Minted, you were at Atomic, and now you are spearheading a startup that is pioneering in AI and facial recognition, and you are the CEO of that company.
That's right.
And talk a little bit about Paravision and your role there and how you found yourself as CEO.
You know, we operate in a very, somewhat controversial space. We do artificial intelligence, and then moreover, we're probably best known for face recognition. And so we want to make sure that face recognition is ethically developed, that it's deployed with customers who are going to use it responsibly. And, you know, we're a small team and we're always, you know, kind of feel like David and Goliath. And I don't know how many times I've been asked the question by whether it's venture capitalists or customers, like, well, how are you going to beat, you know, Google and Microsoft and Amazon in the long run? And you're like, well, you know, we tie our North Star to a benchmark. That's a very objective benchmark that our United States government runs. And we do that every year and we commit to it for ourselves and for our customers. And empirically, we have beaten them.
I want to get to some core questions here around really looking at this ethically built software.
We frequently say, if it doesn't work for everyone, it doesn't work for anyone. And, you know, in the field of face recognition, especially early on in the field, there was definitely an issue where the models were not working for everyone. And I would say specifically for people, you know, often I think frequently in the media, it gets tied to race or skin tone as the axes on which it's not operating the same for everyone, but it's actually the intersection of age, gender, and skin tone. And I think that's actually really important. And I wish there was more about that when people talk about it in the media, because it's not a single threaded thing.
So much complexity.
Yeah, it's a lot of complexity. And to do it right, you have to work across a matrix of all of those factors, environmental factors in the different situations in which people operate. And it's, you know, it's incredibly complex.
There's been so much developed in terms of technology that has not been in support of members of color, people of color, communities of color, where, you know, so many black and brown people have had to flip their hands to the palm side facing up when going to a public, you know, bathroom to get the water to turn on because it wasn't recognizing the darker skin tones.
Yeah.
I mean, this is heartbreakingly ridiculous. How is Paravision, I get the investors' questions about how you can start to prioritize yourself outside of the Amazons and the Googles. How is Paravision positioning themselves to be an organization that develops technology that truly allows for all members of every community to be fully seen, literally and figuratively?
Yeah.
In a way that creates a sense of safety, because your software is literally scanning faces for a purpose.
Yep.
Whether it's to find someone, to support someone, to call someone out.
Yeah. Although I would say first and foremost, that's actually the different approach that we've taken. So there's a lot made, and I totally understand this from a fear perspective. There's a lot made of kind of how face recognition technology is used in a country like China, where you've got sort of a surveillance state and not wanting democratized sort of countries to move into that world. And so we made a really conscious decision from the beginning that there were going to be certain use cases that we were going to support and ones that we weren't going to support. And so we focus on use cases where we've got fully opted in consent that are convenience driven and security driven. And so, and I give a dozen examples, but you know, travel and border security, right? So if I'm going to an airport, I not only expect to be authenticated at the airport.
Sure.
I also, in a lot of cases, actually desire that because it gives me a feeling of safety, right? That this is not only happening to me, it's happening to everyone.
Right.
And so, but how can we make that experience more seamless for everybody?
Well, and also where's the precision piece?
And where's the precision piece? And so can we, if this is going to happen anyway, what's really, really interesting is, listen, if I am a person of a particular skin tone and I'm walking into an airport and I want to be treated a certain way, would I rather have a person who is a completely different skin tone than me and may have their own biases built into their own thinking, checking my ID and giving me a hard time? Or would I rather have a team that is across a pretty wide spectrum of races, religions, genders, et cetera, who's built software that was built for them and that was built for the world with this inclusion included as part of the mix. And so that's what we try to focus on is precision for those convenience use cases. What we specifically don't allow is we don't sell to anybody who's, we have a list of 40 countries that we will not sell to, that we're prohibited to sell to by our AI principles and, that we developed alongside our chief AI ethics advisor, Elizabeth Adams, and our board and our brilliant general counsel, Kamal Chowdhury. And, those principles include, making sure that the conscientious sale, the conscientious, development and sale of the technology, which includes, practically a list of 40 countries we won't sell to, a long list of use cases that we won't sell to. Mm-hmm. And we have to look at the nuance in those things and say like, okay, this use case is okay, but it's in a country that has a history of human rights violations, so we're not going to sell to them.
So you're actually proposing, what I'm hearing is that you could be the answer
to what?
To a very inclusive way of being in this world around a technology that could actually create safety for communities of color that maybe in the past have not experienced that level of safety before.
Yeah, I mean, there's numerous cases. I don't know if we're the answer, but I would say that we try to go to work every day with the explicit goal. The celebrate curiosity is really, really the kind of like the cornerstone of everything that we do, right? And I'll be more explicit about that, and something that I really, really believe. There's a lot of kind of divisiveness in the world that is largely driven by assumption.
Yeah.
People don't assume the best of others. They take tropes and history that may or may not be relevant anymore, or that may have never been relevant, mm-hmm. and they build it into their own biases. And I'm guilty of this. Everybody's guilty of this mm-hmm. in some way, shape, or form on every side of the gender, race, age spectrum. Right. We all have biases. And so the important thing is actually just to recognize that, to be open about it, and to work in an environment where it's safe. And this is going to be maybe a little controversial, but where it's a little safe to be ignorant. And so,
say more about that.
So there's some things we shouldn't be ignorant about anymore in this world because we have enough history. But there are going to be people that come from different backgrounds, right? And who are going to misstep along the way. We're in such an awesome period of transformation of our culture where we're becoming more finely attuned to the way that other people feel in their kind of what their lived experience is. Mm-hmm. And so we're becoming more attuned to that, where we really haven't been attuned to it before. And so as you're going through that transition, and it's a pretty big transition and transformation, even from when I was mm-hmm. growing up, there are going to be some missteps along the way.
Yeah.
And there's going to be, and I think that we try to foster an environment where if you say something that is even mildly offensive to someone else, that person feels safe in saying, you know, first of all, they assume the best of the intent, right? So the person that's receiving that comment that was not welcome assumes the best at the beginning of the intent of that.
And hopefully steps into a place of curiosity.
And then steps into a place of curiosity. And that's the important thing, yeah. is that the person who, in this case, was ignorant to. And I, by the way, when I talk about ignorance, I don't talk about sort of broad, you're ignorant about everything, but ignorance to a specific way that you're making somebody else feel. The person who's on the receiving end of that comment, if they're going to be, if the ignorance is going to be accepted and not sort of be pounced upon, mm-hmm. then the person who's receiving that feedback has to adjust. And it has to be willing to adjust. And I will say people in our company are like, because they're really kind. Like, honestly, if you hire for kindness and curiosity, you do a whole lot to make a really good culture. And I think one of the things that's really, really nice about our culture is that when somebody says something that's not right, they will either publicly or privately, depending on how that person
sure.
can handle it. It's magic when it happens, because then you end up like learning a whole lot too.
I'm getting a little concerned.
Okay.
And the concern has to do with the emotional labor of the person who is on the receiving end of the comment that didn't feel safe.
Yeah.
There's an opportunity, of course, to step into curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
But when that comment continues to come toward the person who doesn't feel safe, mm-hmm. repeatedly after giving feedback.
Yeah.
How is that addressed on your team and your company? What are your thoughts around holding that emotional labor? Because it's not the responsibility of the person totally. Who feels unsafe to constantly be the one to have that sense of curiosity.
100% agree. And this is where frequently, when we see something like that happen and it's come to my attention, we'll just say, listen, you got to do your own reading and research on this. It's not this person's responsibility to teach you this,
right?
And if it happens frequently at all, the person's removed from the company. For what it's worth, it's happened once. And that was a mishire. I thought that, you know, we took a chance on a particular leader who had several comments across several different axes within the first kind of couple of months that were not fitting with this kind of culture and feeling that we have in our company.
What is this culture? When you talk about this culture, what
this sort of the culture of curiosity and safety, and those things have to go together. You know, it's everybody needs to be willing and free and feel free to be able to say, hey, that's not right. Right. And by the way, that's not only about like how we deal with each other personally, that's about our technology and what we're developing there. Like that doesn't feel right. Let's have a conversation about it. And I think the one thing that I really love about the way that we approach it is there is an intellectual curiosity about everything that we're bringing to the fore, which is like, okay, let's look at this from every angle, and there are going to be different perspectives, and then we'll collectively try to sort of come to a decision on that.
You said that you have an AI ethics compliance person, Elizabeth
Adams. She actually sits outside of our company on purpose.
Let's talk more about that. She's a Black woman.
She is. Yeah. And she's brilliant. And one of the things I actually loved when I first met Elizabeth was she's a pragmatist. She's a technologist, right? She wants technology to exist in the world, but she wants it to work for the community. And so she's sort of, I think, deeply involved and committed to technology working for her committee and for her community and for all communities. And, you know, I think one of the things when we first, and we interviewed about, I don't know, a dozen or so different folks for that role. And Elizabeth was one where she's worked in the city of Minneapolis to ban face recognition for use by law enforcement. That particular police department has unfortunately a history of racism and aggression. And she's like, this is not a tool I want to be here. It's not like, I don't believe that this tool shouldn't exist at all. I just don't believe that this group of people under the current training and leadership regime that they had at the time should have this technology. And, you know, our board asked me at the time, they're like, so why are you going to bring this person on board who's trying to get this technology banned? I'm like, well, it's precisely because she's trying to get that technology banned that I want her on board, because she's going to push us to do the right stuff and to make and to make the right decisions. And, you know, kind of best move we ever made. And also that importantly, we've operationalized a lot of the, all of our AI principles into kind of specific operational things that we do in order so that we live up to the standards that we have. She can call us on anything at any time. She doesn't report to me. She reports to the board. Unfortunately, she's never had to do that. But we have brought her in on several occasions when we've had a team disagreement. And even the way that our use case review is set up, Kamal, who's our general counsel, can veto me and I him. And if we have a disagreement, which again, we've never had actually a disagreement on this, and it's part of like when you live your values and your principles and you have enough training doing those things, you end up not having very many disagreements. But we have brought Elizabeth in a couple of times when we were actually just grappling each other in that team that's on the use case review, where we were grappling with something and we didn't know necessarily what the right decision to make was. And so we called her in, and she helped us, I think, come to a great decision.
That's awesome. One of the things that I adore about you is how you exude love. You are a man of faith. You hold that very proudly. I adore that about you. You are very proud to be Christian.
Mm-hmm.
You walk around with your heart on your sleeve all the time. And I love that so much about you. You talk about love in a way that is quite novel in my opinion. You believe in it so strongly that you lead with love is how I see you. Talk about how to lead as a CEO today in a country that is not only so divisive, but in a world that is becoming more and more extreme.
Yeah, I wish you could actually ignore it. I wish the answer was you could just like sort of ignore the outside, but I don't think you can. And by the way, like even in the way that my wife and I sort of parent, you have to stay on top of, if you want to raise kids who are curious and are going to make and are independent. And I promise I'll bring this back to business. I actually think that for me, my family is the most important thing to me in my life, and parenting is. And the issues that, from a global perspective, that are impacting are all of our psychologies. It's like this invisible weight that we're all carrying every single day.
Yeah.
But it sets up this, when we seek to otherize people, and we don't seek to understand, you automatically are in this defensive stance, and it runs through your entire central nervous system. And, this assume the best of others, I would imagine there would be a lot of people that would call it naive, but I know no other way of actually starting from a place of compassion, right? And unless you start from a place of compassion, you're never really going to understand the other person's perspective or put yourself in their shoes. You're always going to have these assumptions or thoughts in your head that you're going to try to counter somebody before they've had an opportunity to actually tell their side of the story. And everybody's got their side of the story.
How do you deal with that internally? Maybe you haven't had this issue at Paravision, but maybe at a prior company, maybe when you were at Amazon, maybe when you were elsewhere. What happens when someone is so defensive that they can't step into a place of curiosity, that they aren't assuming the best intent of others? For whatever reason, maybe they come from 400 years of slavery.
Yeah.
Maybe they come from a lineage that went through genocide.
Yeah.
Maybe it is absolutely warranted that they find themselves in a place of protection because it has been so unsafe for, if not the entirety of their lives, for the generations that came before them.
I think this is one of the greatest gifts I've ever been given was the one that you gave me about this, this idea of epigenetic lineage. And I think it did a couple of things for me. First of all, it helped me understand that it's actually okay to recognize whatever traumas you had in your own life and deal with that, and whatever ones came from your lineage, even if you feel guilty about the fact that they weren't as bad as the traumas that other people suffered. So
the comparison, like, Olympics 101.
Yeah, right. Like, white male, like, had it very, very easy in my life on a relative basis. I grew up in this really kind of dichotomous world where I lived with my mother, who was a school teacher and didn't make a lot of money, and lived in a very small house with three dogs and a whole lot of smoke. She's a chain smoker, three packs a day.
I didn't know that. Did I know that? I don't think I know that.
Yeah. Anyways. and then on the other side, I had my father, who was an entrepreneur, who lived, a state away.
Mm-hmm.
Who was actually pretty successful. And so I sort of grew up in this dichotomous world and was had a divorce happen in our family. And for a long time, I carried that on my back for a very long time, including to when we met each other, as the trauma in my life. Mm-hmm. And I think that I had a hard time just dealing with that kind of trauma and feeling okay about feelings about every once in a while feeling sorry for myself that this happened. And then you wake up and you're like, okay, I didn't have it nearly as bad as everyone else in the world because of the privilege of being a white male in our society and kind of what that carries and what opportunities that have been given to me that I, you know, didn't earn relative to other folks who were probably more deserving of the opportunities that I've had. And so just on the genetic Olympics, or not genetic Olympics, genetic lottery is, I think, you know, Warren Buffett called it. And so, but the one gift was, can I forgive myself for being able to deal with my own traumas in life? And then, and more importantly, you gave me the ability to not only understand as much as I wanted to, I'm actually never going to understand what it's like to be a person of color, to feel unsafe in the world in general, to be a woman or to be trans or to be gay. I'm not going to understand the bigotry and the judgment that comes along with being who you are. And all of the years and millennia of baggage and weight that comes along with that. And so when somebody gets really, really defensive about something that's impacted them, you can't, the instinct is to be like, oh, no, I didn't mean that. Or that wasn't my intention. And it's like, quite frankly, it doesn't matter. The first instinct should be to say, I'm sorry. Mm. Help me understand. And when we say to our boys, and it's not help me understand, you need to educate me, but I'm very, very sorry I made you feel that way by my words or my actions. And I never want to make you feel that way again. And it wasn't my intent, but I know it hurt you anyway. Can we have a conversation about it? Do you feel comfortable having a conversation about it? Because if you don't, then that's not your problem. I'll go educate myself, but I would love to just learn right on the spot because it's fresh now. And I think, you know, for me, the number one part of my faith, but I don't think it's exclusive to Christianity. I think it's every faith, and there's a reason it's every faith. It's just part of being human. Mm-hmm. Forgiveness is so important. Understanding that you're not right all the time is important. And if you're not right all the time, you can't always expect other people to forgive you, but you should be quick to forgive if you can, and quick to help improve yourself. And quite frankly, if you can, help improve the world a little bit. And so what I've always found is that one-on-one conversations are the best way to make that happen.
Yeah, it's true.
And if you're in a situation where there's been a conflagration of some sort, you as a leader, you both have to take a stand and say publicly, okay, that's not all right. We're going to have a conversation about this separately. Mm-hmm. Because you don't want to, if you try to prosecute things publicly, then everybody loses. But you have to recognize it as well. So you have to recognize it, name it, and then pull it aside and work to heal. And
repair.
To repair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love this so much. Where does humility fall in this encompassing of a CEO and leading an organization publicly in the world's eye?
I think it's probably the most important characteristic. I don't know if we all do it that well all the time, self included, but I would actually say humility in general. In to me, humility and curiosity kind of go hand in hand.
I agree.
Right? If you think you know the answer to everything, you'll never ask the question.
Nice.
You know, and so and I would also say though at the same time that on the inside, I think everybody is actually inherently humble. And this may come as a, maybe this is a controversial statement, but
I say to our
boys, like, listen, if you're feeling insecure about something, no worries. Insecurity is the human condition, right?
This is so great.
So
insecurity is the gateway to humility.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's
as opposed to the gateway to self-deprecation.
Yeah,
Narcissism. Yeah. Narcissism, right?
Yeah, and it's the way that unfortunately it's the way it shows up because, again, I was blessed to have you as a mentor at a time that was really really important in my life. But I think one of the things that I don't think I really realized just how insecure I was and am.
Yeah,
and the eye-opener for me as part of our work, and you didn't say it explicitly ever, but the eye-opener for me was like, listen, everybody's got their shit, their personal feelings of inadequacy or self-loathing and that's like, that's just inherent to the human condition, but it's really wonderfully freeing when you recognize that everybody's that way.
Yeah.
Right? Wonderfully freeing.
I just want to thank you, rewinding a little bit back to when you were talking and you got emotional. There was a little bit of wetness in your eyes as you were speaking. And I really appreciated that of you because this is the way that you navigate yourself. And I love that level of transparency. I love the heart-centeredness of who you are so much. Earlier in our pre-talk, before we started recording, you mentioned something called the poverty of hope. Mm-hmm. Talk more about what the poverty of hope is to you. I just really enjoyed how you kind of explained what it was and how it's relevant today, especially what you're doing with facial recognition.
So first of all, I did not get a PhD in, sort of what's going on in the world today. I frankly work with a lot of PhDs who are so much smarter than I am. That's very humbling in and of itself every day. But several years ago, obviously every major U.S. city right now is dealing with a sort of crises of sort of drug abuse, fentanyl abuse, dealing with homelessness, which to me is just like a solvable travesty. And in addition to that, we're dealing with these like youth crises, which is people that are sons and daughters that are getting wrapped up in devices early on and and starting to feel self-conscious and starting to be insecure at an earlier and earlier age. And there's this, and then you've got what's going on, that's sort of the macro, what's going on in the world, which is sort of climate change leading to like a lot of disasters. And you've got the war in Ukraine, et cetera. It's just like, it's a tense time. And there's a weight that comes along with that that we're all carrying. And then on the heels of a pandemic. And so there's this kind of like sense of hopelessness and a little bit of helplessness that comes along with that weight. And when I say poverty of hope, what I mean is that you get wrapped in kind of a downward spiral from all of this weight that's really difficult to extract yourself from. And you know, I look at sort of literally the box that we've put ourselves in from a device perspective and isolated ourselves from the world as one of the main, you know, alongside all these other things that's happening, that's exacerbating the problem. Like, listen, I have a phone. I use it every day. I love it. It's amazing, right? It helps me do stuff. But where I try to be more intentional with my family, our kids are much better than both my wife or I at like not using devices because we've largely prohibited it for a really long time. But we, you know, we have an old abalone shell that we found on the beach up in sort of Northern California a while ago. Every day when we come home, we put our phones in the abalone shell. And for this sacred time where we have dinner and we talk to each other.
Oh, I love that so much.
We don't look at our phones.
And
then of course, once the kids go to bed, you know, it's right back like, oh, what happened in the news today? Stay up to date on things and maybe you should check my email or whatever. Yeah. So definitely not perfect and very comfortable with that. But at the same time, I do recognize that this thing that we're addicted to actually spirals all of our other hopelessness and addiction in a really, really negative way. And so for how it relates to our development of AI, I'm not sure I entirely understand, but I do know that sort of being being cognizant of the world and this place where people are going to not only judge our technology, and rightly so, on its effectiveness across a really, really broad swath of humanity, you know, makes me come into work every day with a mission, which is to make sure that it works for everybody and to create an environment where the people that are actually doing that work can make it work for everybody.
That it works for everybody as much as possible and where you can make a change.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I will 100% say this is a journey too. I mean, we've come so far as an industry in a very short period of time, and there are, you know, the, what we say at Paravision is both, it doesn't work for everybody unless it works for everybody. The flip side of that is that this is always a journey, right? We can always improve, and that technology as a whole, not just on an individual segment basis, but we can always improve.
Absolutely.
And I actually probably, having said that, I will say as a person, I've probably been too focused on self-improvement in my life to the point where I don't always enjoy, I enjoy the process of improvement because that's just like the way that I'm wired. But I probably don't always enjoy the sort of the fruits of that because I'm so focused on like, oh, if there's something wrong, well, clearly I can fix it and make it better. Right. And sometimes you just need to kind of like sit and be okay and be relaxed about the fact that you're not going to ever be perfect.
And I think for me, where we are as leaders in organizations is at this precipice of truly being able to sit in a place of discomfort in moments that are divisive, moments that are uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I think we instinctively want to get away from discomfort the moment that it arises because it's uncomfortable, right? And yet being able to sit in that discomfort is absolutely key. Part of one of the tenets of white supremacy is learned helplessness. Mm-hmm. The contingency of learned helplessness, the core contingency of learned helplessness, is uncontrollability. Mm-hmm. Now, as leaders, we spend so much time in volatility, in uncertainty, in complexity, in ambiguity, and we have to navigate those fields and those experiences and environments constantly, meeting to meeting to meeting, right? The antidote to learned helplessness, if the contingency is uncontrollability, the antidote is controllability. But that's hard to do, because then that elicits a lot of micromanaging. It elicits defensiveness. It elicits maybe taking action in a way that feels abrupt or hurried in some capacity. How do we navigate discomfort in a conversation when there is the hustle, there is the urgency that exists in this paradigm of white supremacy?
So I would say, first of all, I think the reason why people, especially who are white, find discomfort with the word white supremacy is you never want to be labeled a racist as your entire
course
kind of as your entire grouping or other group. You don't want to be, you don't want to say to an entire group of people, you're the problem. And I clearly, I'm, as a white male, I am part of the problem, right? And I am the beneficiary of millennia of structural racism that has allowed me to have the privilege that I have. And what you do with that privilege is the is hopefully the important thing. Do you try to change it? Where I have a hard time and where I have a lot of discomfort is I also don't want to be polarizing. And as soon as you name it, and there's a guy, I'm forgetting his name, but this gentleman makes it his mission in life to go around and sit down with members of the Ku Klux Klan.
Daryl Davis.
Thank you. I love that, because talk about sitting in discomfort.
Holy shit.
Like that, you're walking
incredible.
In to like hostile territory.
I just invite everyone who's listening or watching, if you have not seen Daryl Davis's TED Talk, please go watch his TED Talk. It gives me goosebumps every single time.
And there's a documentary on him, and there's a brilliant New York Times article. More has been written about this guy. More needs to be written about him, because
tell the story, because it's such an amazing story.
He goes around and sits down with grandmasters.
Yep.
And sits down with, you know, other people that are very proud white supremacists.
Yep.
And I think this is actually really, really important. He seeks to understand.
Yeah.
And he doesn't come in full of judgment.
Yep.
And he comes in with forgiveness in his heart.
Yeah. Everything you've talked about today.
And he doesn't.
Yeah.
He doesn't necessarily seek to change people.
Correct.
And I think that's really, really important, is like, if you seek to change because you assume you know.
Nice.
Then that's the first error, right? But if you seek to understand,
yeah,
the change will happen.
Yes.
And what he does and what he believes at his core is he believes that thing I was saying earlier, which is that people are intrinsically good and they've either been taught to hate or they've inherited hate.
Yeah.
And he sits down
and
breaks bread. And by the way, just the fact that he's willing to, I don't know how he gets these people to sit down with him, given their sort of stated beliefs, but he sits down with them. He goes into hostile territory and he's like, you know, basically, I'm going to trust in God that I'm going to be okay in this environment. Yeah. And I'm going to break bread and I'm going to seek to understand and seek to be understood. And magic happens.
Magic happens. Beautifully said, Doug. It's an incredible story. He actually had one grandmaster give up his uniform.
Yeah.
And they became really, to this day,
friends.
They're really good friends to this day. So I'm getting so emotional. I want to start crying. It's such a beautiful story. I love that you know who Daryl Davis is, and I love that you brought it into the conversation. Thank you.
But that is to me the ultimate example of sitting in discomfort. And so when I think if I'm ever uncomfortable, you know, I just think to this guy who also has like.
Yeah,
I've never felt, as I said earlier, I've never felt unsafe in the world. And here's a guy literally going in and walking in and just like, hey, I'm going to get to know you.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful. It's really, really beautiful. And but what our environment does to us is it pushes us away from each other. Algorithms push us away from each other and make us feel safe and secure in what we
in silos
what we know. And
so beautifully said.
And so I think that sort of curiosity to sort of go beyond your silo and to not get wrapped up in the box is super important.
What advice? I love that. What advice would you give to someone who is trepidatious about going beyond their silo?
It's a beautiful world out there, and there's a whole lot more good than I do believe this, and I won't rip on media broadly. Media exists for a reason, but what I will say is that the way that media, the business of media is at this point to sensationalize, to get clicks, and therefore everything that you, the headline, and we are trained to only read headlines. Because that's where the dopamine rush comes in. As soon as you dive deep, the dopamine fades away.
What a great point.
And so the only thing I would say, like,
as soon as you dive deep, the dopamine fades away.
Seriously, it's like the sensationalist.
That's such a great point.
Right? And so the thing I would say is like,
wow.
Rest in your discomfort of reading further and don't get caught up in the headlines. And then what ends up happening is end up seeing the nuance in the world.
Oof.
Right. And the thing is that like at the end of the day, most things aren't binary.
If anything, but
if anything,
we'll go there.
But like, basically stories, decisions, et cetera, they're not binary.
Yeah.
There's this nuance that exists across the spectrum. And unless you actually sit in the discomfort of, and I've always been a reader, so like I love to read the whole thing.
Yeah.
But unless you sit in the discomfort of reading the whole thing, then you don't do that. And it's like, by the way, the writer of the story may have not, their intent may not have been to sensationalize, but the editor is going to go in and be like, how do I sex up this story? Right? Let me get a click on this thing so that I can get ads and sell ads and, you know, all this crap. The writer, there's some really actually quite good journalism that happens. Right. And at the same time, journalism in and of itself has become more opinionated. So if you just read one thing, you're only getting one side of the story. So, but it's, I would just say go deeper.
You sing at church.
I do.
You love singing
at
church.
I'm so sorry to all the people at church have to put up with my voice. I sing in the shower too. That's much
I don't know
better
about
in the
that.
Shower.
I need to come to your church and listen to you sing. When you talk about singing at church, it excites you. It brings you joy. I can see your face light up. You told me the story in our pre-talk about going to Bishop Ranch.
Yeah.
What excites you most about AI? What is it that, in its most optimistic form, you think will revolutionize society and take us to a place of inclusivity?
I think we should all work a little bit less.
Yeah, you have a 4-day work week.
We have been experimenting with a 4-day work week since the beginning of this year, and it's going very, very well.
Good.
I do believe that, so first of all, one of the things that comes out of that is extreme focus.
The 4-day work week.
The 4-day work week, yeah. I mean, we get more done now than I think we ever have before.
And how many hours a day are you working?
We don't count. The hours of day.
So okay, you just show up and work. Okay, great.
Yeah, we're output, you know, driven. Yeah. And actually, I would say it's interesting. We're actually input driven, in a way. We agree to what the inputs are, and we agree that this is going to be the way to have the best outcomes. And then if we all agree as a group that these are going to be the best inputs, these are going to be the things that we tackle, then the outcomes are going to be what they're going to be.
Nice.
Like, we don't have any control over that.
I love
that. We don't penalize people for bad outcomes if we've all agreed to the inputs. Mm-hmm. But what I would say is, like, we're more focused, happy, and healthy as a group than we've ever been.
Yeah.
And it came at a really kind of like stressful moment in our company's history, quite frankly, in the history of every venture-backed company, when SVB collapsed and the venture mm-hmm. market, you know, kind of disintegrated for a period of time. And so right. like, how do you deal with people's like rising levels of cortisol, right? And one of the ways that we dealt with that was we said, like, let's take a little bit of time for ourselves and see how it works. We've all these studies in Japan and with Microsoft that yeah. say that this is the, you know, better way to do it. And so what I do believe is that that AI, when used intentionally and thoughtfully, can help improve our lives from a how much work we're doing and how much time we're spending on the important work. And the important work is the stuff that we're talking about today. The important work is people work and it's creative work. And I don't think, even though AI's gotten actually quite good at doing some creative work too, that's all derivative of human work, it is not, there are places where it can really, really help sort of decrease the amount of, you know, literal labor and minutia labor that we're doing. And the flip side of that, of course, is that there is going to be a period of time where, and we're in it right now, mm-hmm. and it's going to be a long period of time where certain forms of AI are going to radically impact the economy and people's lives in a negative way.
Mm.
And specifically, there are going to be probably career categories that go out the window, and people will need to be retrained, and there's going to have to be some social safety netting. I don't think we've seen really the beginning. I've seen we're just at the very, 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 very beginning of that curve. Mm. And I do believe that over the long arc of history, and the same thing that happened in the Industrial Revolution, like, new jobs will appear, but there's going to be a period of time where I think job categories are eliminated. And that's going to be really hard. Now, I want to be careful here. This is not, people often say AI broadly. I think there's narrow AI. And that's what we do, is like, we're specifically focused on specific tasks.
Yep.
Where for, in our case, convenience and security can be improved both by through the introduction of this technology. And that has some social harms that have been done and can be done if you don't keep your eye on the right use cases and you don't keep your eye on the development of that technology in a responsible way. And then there's AGI, artificial general intelligence. And that's what I think people largely talk about when they're talking about AGI mm-hmm. today, or the fear of that. We're not at AGI yet, but with, you know, OpenAI and Anthropic and Google all putting out, you know, what are in effect, you know, like very, very like intelligent computers that have the benefit of the entire internet as their training mechanism, and all of the vitriol and hate and stuff that comes along with that. And I think those companies, for what it's worth, are very aware of that. And at the same time, I think even they recognize, and they've been very vocal about this, that they need yeah. some boundaries to work
100%.
With. 100%. Right. So, yeah, it's both as normally technology introductions are, it is both an incredibly, it's a time of great hope and it's a time of great fear.
Yeah.
And the nuance is the stuff that matters. Mm, and
I love that.
And unfortunately, our legislative bodies are not always great at nuance.
Nicely said.
European legislative bodies actually happen to be quite good at nuance.
Nicely said.
But I think in the US, it's going to be a long and uncomfortable education for all of us, and our leaders, our country's leaders, need to be able to. And I think they're educating themselves But they need to not think in sound bites and start thinking about the nuance of the issues.
I fully agree. I am, I think now, 3 months into my CEO-ship with I Belong, and I'm ready to resign. No, wait, was that my outside voice?
That was your outside voice.
Damn it. What advice do you have for me, for those of us who are starting our journey as a CEO, growing a company, trying to figure it out?
Well, for you specifically, you're the expert. So I would say listen to your own shit and you'll be fine. Forgive my French. Like, you've been so helpful to me as a leader, Rajkumari, that that I would just really sort of focus on the things that you do well and that you speak about so eloquently, and you'll be a great leader. And then the other thing that I would say is just take time for yourself and stay healthy.
Yeah.
The thing that I think is hardest about, there's a couple of things that are very, very hard about being a CEO. From my experience, I don't know if this is all CEOs, but I'll speak from my own experience. One is you have to context switch.
Yes.
Constantly throughout the day.
Oh my God.
Finance, marketing, speaking engagement, sales. And
so true.
And to bring your authentic self into all of those discussions, it's hard and it's exhausting. It's mentally exhausting. And so taking time for yourself and taking time for whatever is restorative to you, I think is insanely important. And I don't always, like, by the way, I'll give advice that I don't always follow. I don't always take enough time.
Yeah.
You can preach all you want, but I don't always take enough time. And the only other thing that I would say is that, I don't want to say this about maybe startups specifically, because I've actually never run a really big company. But I imagine it's probably the same for everyone, which is that, I often say, like, the ratio of punches in the face to high fives is like 5-1
in favor of
the punches in the face.
I was afraid you were going to say that.
And even when things are going well, right? Yeah. Sometimes it's 10-1.
And yeah, I got a couple punches yesterday, and they were very unexpected, and I had to navigate that, and it was a challenge. But it was a good thing. I was headed off to acupuncture right after. So.
Oh, good. Yeah, it's that self care, right? So what I would say is actually getting very comfortable.
Yeah.
With the bad.
Yeah. Once again, sitting in discomfort.
Yeah, right? and I think there's,
and not taking it personally.
Yeah.
And that in and of itself is, you know, you need 14 therapists to help you do that. So
yeah, and forgiving yourself, by the way. Like, I mean, like, you, anyone in that role is going to screw up so many times
100%.
Along the way, just every human does.
Oh my gosh. Yes, I'm thinking of one major screw up right now. But yeah absolutely. With a coaching client, no less.
Yeah. And then, well, and the easiest thing we tell our boys, the easiest words in the English language are, I'm sorry.
They are. They should be. They could be.
It's like, I'm sorry. Actually, and I would say the power to word ratio in the words, I'm sorry. And I tell our team, and some members of our team are much better at this than I am. So I don't tell them, but what I tell the team is, like, in any interaction, you can always find something that you would, even if you feel like you've been harmed.
Yeah.
You can always find something that you can apologize for. And it can't be inauthentic, but if you really think about it, you'll be like, oh man, maybe I could have approached that differently. Maybe I could have been less defensive. Maybe I could have used different phraseology that would have landed better. And so what the words I'm sorry do is they disarm people for a conversation.
Right. And to be clear, there's a period after the word sorry, not I'm sorry that I made you feel.
Yeah.
There's a period after sorry.
Yes. It's I'm sorry. And it, by the way, the next word better not be but.
Very, absolutely.
But
That just modeling.
So the, when you say, I'm sorry, what ends up happening to people's kind of defense mechanisms is they're immediately disarmed and they're like, whoa, I didn't expect that.
Exactly.
All right. And then what next words you say are very important too.
Right.
So choose them wisely.
I just want to kind of pause here because the I'm sorry actually gets you, is the gateway to the cortisol to actually start to de-escalate it.
Yeah.
And that is what is so key about what you're saying here.
Yep.
Doug, it's always a pleasure to have you. What an amazing conversation.
Thanks for having me.
I want to just thank you so much for your vulnerability, for your courage, for your bravery, for speaking from your heart as you always do. It's one of the many things that I adore about you.
Well, likewise.
That was Rajkumari Niyogi and Doug Ailey. Up next, A New Vision for Humanity with Dr. Sharif Abdullah. Visit us at podcast.ibelong.com for all the ways to watch and listen to our show. You've been listening to Then, Now, and Tomorrow, an I Belong original series produced by Flowship. Today's episode was executive produced by Rajkumari Niyogi, produced by Mike Giordani, edited by Ramiro Gava, mixed by Alex Roses, original music by Dario Valderrama, production assistance by Tiari Boutte and Pili Melendez. Thank you so much for tuning in.